Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts with a focus on Kenpo. As always, I am your host, Reggie Darden, and today I'm excited to speak with Mr. Sean Knight, and we're going to talk about his journey in Kenpo and in the martial arts and whatever other items we decide to talk about. We'll get to that as well. As of recording here, I have not yet released, but I did interview his wife, Rebecca Knight. And so that will be releasing really soon. But we are here to learn about Mr. Knight here. So I usually start things off by just giving a little background of my history there. I currently train in multiple martial arts, primarily American Kenpo. But I also trained in Capoeira, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Muay Thai, Hapkido, and I've done some boxing and some Taekwondo. So I like to say that I stay pretty busy along with holding down a day job and wife and dogs and all that good stuff. I stay pretty busy with the podcast as well. So that's a little bit of my story, but now we will turn it over to our esteemed guest. And how did the martial arts find you? How did Kenpo find you? And kind of where did it all begin?
Well, my my first class was December 5th of 1990. And the reason I took martial arts, I had kind of a rough childhood. And then in high school, I got into an altercation with like about half a football team. I almost flipped my car over and I had a fractured left orbit. And so one of my friends actually purchased a self-defense like first five lesson trial course for me and him. And from the very first class, I just knew this is something I'm going to not only do, but it's going to be a big part of my life going forward.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. Now, was this particular course like Kenpo based or?
Yeah, it was. It was a Tracy's version of Kenpo or Traco, a branch of the Kenpo system. So that, I mean, for those people that know the Ed Parker system and the Tracy system, the Tracy's were Ed Parker's students early in his career, and they kind of broke away and did their thing. And their Kenpo was a little bit different. Some people would call it like the 70s version or what have you. But anyway, that was the version that I started in. And so there were more self-defense techniques numerically and so forth. But in the organization I began in was Bill Packer's organization, and there was a huge focus on fighting and kickboxing. And so for me, that was kind of the real draw. The Kenpo was cool and I really liked it, but it was like, you know, sparring class and contact class. That was really where it was at for me early in my career anyway.
Okay. We're, I guess, a little bit similar, at least as far as the starting point. So the school that I started with was of the Tracy lineage. So my instructor was Chicken Gabriel. And then his instructor was a man by the name of Dick Wellick, who's got his black belt through the Tracy's. So kind of similar, we're on the same similar starting point there. So it was love at first sight. And what do you think kind of drew you in the most?
Well, I mean, it was a sense of empowerment that I was kind of lacking. So for me, it was just the whole martial arts, the culture of it, where we did like things in a very disciplined way, and we did everything in like a manner in which was just designed to build you up and strengthen the body and just condition you so that you could do whatever was required, whether it was, you know, toughening up our shins so that we could check those leg kicks as you did some Muay Thai as did I. If you don't check those, you're not going to be standing very long. So you'd have to toughen up those legs and kind of do those things. And I just like the timing drills and a lot of those things. I ironically hated katas. now I'm really fond of them, but at the time I was like, this is ridiculous. I just want to like do hands-on techniques and spar and do like the physicality part. And of course, you know, you tend to need the practice, the things that you avoid. And so years later, I had to come back and really hone in on the forms and so forth. But in 2005, Bill Packer passed away, and I had branched away from his organization. And that's when I met Stephen LeBounty, and he was Al Tracy's third black belt. So he grew up in the Tracy system as well, but he also branched over into the Ed Parker Kenpo. And so he was kind of my bridge to bring me from the Traco version to the Parker system. And I kind of credit him with opening most of the doors for Kenpo. I did meet Mr. Wedlake the same weekend I met Stephen LeBounty. But I'll be honest with you, Mr. Wedlake was a much more refined type martial artist, very cerebral. Mr. LeBounty was like a Hulk smash type person. And so I sort of identified with that first. And now I'm presently working with Mr. Sepulveda and Mr. Wedlake extensively with Mr. Wedlake, and he's putting a much more fine edge on my sword, so to speak. But I wasn't ready for him at that time because he does things a little bit differently, and I needed to, best way I could say it would be mature in the art, because I was still a little bit too Hulk smash.
Yeah, I got you. I got you. I can kind of relate, and so since kind of also similar, I switched from the Tracy's to the Ed Parker version, and I struggled with some of the differences, and there are things that in my current school we do that we didn't do in my previous school, and that sort of thing. So anytime I have somebody that's trained in the different versions there, did you have struggles going from one system to another? Or,
you know, the short answer is yes. I mean, quite a bit. The long answer is it was more complicated because I was also running a school at that time. And so it wasn't just about me transitioning myself and my particular learning model and practicing model. I was transitioning like 100 people with me at the same time. It was give or take a few. And so in so doing that, I mean, I'm doing this full time. This is my career. I live, sleep, breathe this thing. But my students don't. They've got like day jobs and they're regular, you know, they're regular folks. They go to work and come home, and then they do their Kenpo in their spare time and so forth. And so when I switched over my school to the Parker system, the best way that I found to do that was to implement a rotating curriculum. And I did that in 2005 and 2006. And we've been kind of doing that. So we have three tiers of beginner material, or three charts. If you think like an old school martial artist, there's like a list of requirements and you got to fulfill that and you move to the next. We have three lists for beginners. And it doesn't matter whether you start at rotation 1, 2, or 3. They're like three semesters. You just got to accumulate all three, and then each one represents one rank or belt. And then you go to the intermediates, and there's three in the advanced. The good news about doing it that way is it also forces like my students seasonally to train the system. So we review the system every year, but we're doing it in 4-month chunks, so it's a little more manageable. The Kenpo system is large. There's a lot of material, and so it's kind of a better way to do that as opposed to just saying, you know, you got to remember 154 techniques all the time and just run through them. It's easier if you break them up into three swatches of material. So even the black belts, they're still practicing the beginner material, but they're just adding layers and depths to what they're doing, and the forms, of course, advance as well.
Okay, very nice, very nice. And so it's a combination of the Parker and the Traco and all of that, or is there any?
No, I'll be honest with you. There's a couple of things that we brought in from the Traco system, or that still kind of linger, but they're more extras or drills and some of the things like this. Most of the things that I teach are right out of Mr. LeBounty and Mr. Sepulveda, Mr. Wedlake, Mr. White. Those are my four key people that I've learned most of the Ed Parker's Kenpo from. We teach exclusively what they've showed us in our regular material, so the techniques and so forth. I have different names for the techniques, but that's just because there were some copyright issues or whatever. And so I was like, well, I'm not going to step into any of that. So I just renamed and sequenced the techniques in the way I thought was most appropriate for the learning model. And keeps me in the clear that way. But it is exactly the material that the founder of the system created, or at least the EPEX that I know.
Okay, gotcha. So with that, it's funny to me how Ed Parker is very much known for continually evolving and changing the arts, and but yet, you know, not for there to be that drama, but there is that there are the folks out there that are, oh well, this isn't the, you know, the Ed Parker way or anything like that. So I'm curious, was there concern kind of going in and developing your own system? Was there concern about stepping on anybody's toes or offending anybody or anything like that with kind of doing your own thing?
You know, ironically, I mean, I when I first was coming into it, I was just throwing myself into the work. And so I was a bit overwhelmed with the idea of, you know, changing and transforming and morphing this material that I was working through. And so I was really just in the middle of the projects. I was up to my neck in alligators. And then, you know, of course, as you start creating content or people start to come in and see what you're doing or however you get exposure, you find people that are like, that's not the way, you know, I did it or whatever. Somebody's going to have some critique or whatever. And yes, I got a lot of that kind of stuff. And initially I took great offense to it. And I'm like, I'm going to defend my position and go in these chat rooms and, you know, give them a piece of my mind or something. And then it very shortly after that occurred to me, like, what am I doing? I'm talking to somebody on a computer that I can't really, I'm not really going to make a difference to anyway. And so, and if it depends on what they're, why they're critiquing or whatnot. Sometimes people get locked into the tradition, or this is the way that I learned it. And so it's just, they're rigidly locked into their perspective. And I understand how that works because I've been around enough martial artists. But if you get around a few of the right ones, they'll say, this is the way I do it. Mr. Sepulveda says something before his seminars. He says, I'm not going to teach you the way. I'm going to show you a way. And then he shares the way he does it. And so he also allows me to, although he coaches me and Mr. Wedlake coached me now, they allow me to do it in a way in which I want to present the material and so forth. But I very much give great respect and deference to them because they learned directly from the founder of the system. They had a relationship with Ed Parker. And so I try to honor the gift that they give me and that they were given from him. So I try to teach the techniques true to the form of their design. And at the same time, I allow the method that I teach it, the order that I teach it, and the sequencing that we do it in to be my own and so forth. So there's kind of a balancing act, but I think there's a line between, you know, tradition, and you want to preserve the teachings of the masters because they really paved the roads we walk on today. At the same time, we want to make sure that we continue to modernize the methods and the training models. You know, I mean, even in the old days of sparring, we used to get concussions all the time. It was just hard sparring every class, you know, and there are people nowadays that still believe that. Like, you got to hard spar every class. I'm like, well, yeah, but I tell my wife all the time, without all these concussions, imagine how smart I would have been. You know, and she laughs a little bit, but there's smarter and better ways to train. So we have to, while give deference to tradition and teach what the masters taught, we also have to evolve and allow it to move forward in the new ways that we find that may be better in training.
Yeah, there's definitely a work smarter, not harder.
Yeah, and with care, mentality. You can train longer.
Yeah, exactly. If you take care of your partners, you can still get that good hard training, but still be well enough to do again the next day.
Yeah, balance is very important. That's right.
Yeah. I find it. Guess how do I want to say this? There's a general softening in, I don't know, I guess today's culture. And it kind of, I find it funny that there are so many people that are training martial arts, which is right? In its most basic sense, it's a combat art, but yet there are so many people that when it's when it's sparring night, everybody has something to do that night and can't make it. I definitely am not interested in the kind of quote unquote blood and guts days of the training. I don't like to get beat up, but at the same time, I do want to get beat up a little bit. Finding that middle point is, we have to be somewhere in between, and it's good to hear that teachers still want to do that instead of just, quote unquote, chasing the rank or chasing the quote unquote big paycheck that comes from teaching martial arts.
I think that's a bit of an illusion too, kind of like rank. I mean, you hope to get honored at some point in your career, but it should just be a byproduct of what you do. It shouldn't be something you're kind of actively chasing at a certain level anyway.
Gotcha. So with your training, has it just been Kenpo? Have you been involved in any other arts?
Early on, ironically enough, when I was in my first martial arts organization, they didn't want us to really cross train at all. They wanted us just to only be in their group. So they didn't want us to do anything. So they said we couldn't even buy like Ed Parker's Infinite Insights. And so I immediately went down to Ed Parker's studio and bought the set of Infinite Insights so I could read the forbidden books or whatever. So whenever somebody would say, you can't do this or you can't do that, I'd be like, what do you mean? Why can't I know this? And so I did dabble in some different styles. I went to a lot of seminars early on in my career, and got some great exposure to a lot of great martial arts. I did a Tai Chi seminar with Dennis Brown, and it was a fantastic seminar. It was like 2 or 3 hours, and I was so young and impatient. I just couldn't get a lot of value because it was Tai Chi, and we're moving through the flow of cultivating this and the balance, and it's going super dirt slow. And I'm like, could we hurry up and hit people eventually? and I laugh at myself now looking back, but I couldn't really appreciate all the arts at that time. And I had a great friend of mine, Brian Malm. His black belts and brown belts instructors class used to come to our Kenpo school, and we would spar them in our school with Kenpo rules so we could have groin kicks and everything else. And then we'd go over to his Taekwondo school, but it was Taekwondo rules in his house, and so we didn't do the groin kicks and so forth. And he would do like some, heel hooks and things, and I thought I was just going to fade back and then pop in and range out and really get a shot. And he stopped that kick on a dime, and he did a ball kick right into my eye. So it heel hook, reversed it and kicked me right in the face. And so I immediately, after class, I took him aside and said, hey, can you show me that? I need to learn that. And so we would immediately share ideas. He's still my friend in town. He operates a school, Desert Taekwondo, and he's a fantastic martial artist. He cross-trained a lot, but I kind of credit him for being my elder brother in the arts that opened up my eyes to the fact that other martial arts are not just valid, they're incredible, and you can see different techniques that you've never seen before. And if you've seen something before, then you have a better shot at being able to defend yourself or put yourself into a mindset of hey, things happen in different drills other than the ones you probably encounter in your studio or your particular art. And so he opened that up. And then recently me and my wife have done some locksmith work. That's the name of the program. It was developed by Phil Buck. And his dad was a world-class judo player and judoka, and he also did some Japanese jiu-jitsu and so forth. So most of it is standing grappling work. We take the guy to the ground and things like this. But I also worked for Arizona prison complex up in Florence. And so when I did that for a year, I did a lot of, I wouldn't call it jiu-jitsu, but it was a lot of groundwork, cuffing people and doing things like this. So it was a lot of hands-on. I had some wrestling experience in high school, so that was helpful too.
Very nice. But
Kenpo
very nice.
Is my primary thing. Yeah, Kenpo is the big part of my life. Everything else, I would say, is more of a kind of a sideline just to get exposure and experience.
Very nice. Yeah, I like it. Obviously, I'm a big fan of cross training because I'm the big man at the buffet. I can't just taste one dish. I gotta have kind of everything. But I think it's important to be exposed, at least exposed to different things and you know see what best fits. Fits the individual, so I like that.
Yeah, when I was growing up in Mr. Packer's organization, he had a lot of world champion kickboxers, so I got to spar with people like Johnny Moncayo and Mike Winklejohn and Lee Sprague and people like this, which are like real even Mike Winklejohn still operates Jackson Winklejohn out of Albuquerque. They train a lot of fighters and stuff, and so he kicked me in the head a lot.
very nice. So with the very sparring heavy background, did you get into the competing side of things?
You know, I did a lot of tournaments early on, and I did some we did the big tournament circuits, like the Mile High Classic and some of the larger events and whatnot. My wife recently competed in the internationals. She got grand champion in form. She did form four. I was more of a fighting guy. Like I was mentioning, I like katas now, but at the time I was like, I don't want to do that part. I just want to spar. And then they added self-defense techniques. I'm like, well, I'll do that too, because at least it's hands-on. You know, we get to do something with somebody. And then I got into forms, and one of my previous instructors said, I was all up for a challenge pretty much all the time, you know, and he'd said, I challenge you, Mr. Knight, to do form five in tournament until you win first place with it. And so I accepted the challenge, like, you know, on the spot, just because I was challenged, but I hated form five. And so I had to run this form, and I think I went to like, it was 12 or 13 tournaments before I finally took first place with that form. And ironically, looking back on it, I was really pissed and frustrated the whole time I was practicing. So I was doing this angry form five, you know, and stomping through it and really upset. But the work and the angst that I put into the form and the amount of time and effort it kind of forced into me and the product that came out was I'm much better at a lot of the transitions in form fives, particularly takedowns and things like this. So my transitions are much more fluid. So the forms have tremendous value, but you have to kind of extract it. And I think it depends on your persona largely. But typically speaking, earlier in training, if you have like a physicality thing, the forms are a bit of an afterthought. I mean, you do them to get the belt. It's required. I got to know that thing or whatever. But you're not really extracting a lot of the lesson and value that is from that. I see a lot of modern schools now that are just throwing the forms completely away. And I have a strong feeling that is a mistake, and it's a mistake that early in my career I was guilty of, in fact, making. So I can kind of see it from the long haul perspective and go, yeah, you know, when you're a young man, you want to just forget all the basic like block movements. You want to teach fluidity right away, right? And every instructor thinks that's going to be a good idea, and there are no shortcuts. You have to go through certain, you know, paths of travel and full range of motion before you can begin to abbreviate and do a lot of, you know, feints and slips and some of the more nuanced things that are required to learn, but you can't learn those on the first day.
Exactly.
But yeah, you got to learn that the hard way, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm a little bit reverse in that I always wanted to do the forms, and now I'm more interested in the fighting aspect than the form. I mean, I still love forms, don't get me wrong, but I feel like I'm more interested in the fighting part of it now. Of course, in my older age and my body is not as tough as it used to be. Not saying that it was really ever that tough, but it's like I don't heal as fast as I used to, so maybe I should focus more on the forms than fighting. But
we joke a lot that our Pez dispensers at this age are filled with ibuprofen instead of candy.
I like that. That reminds me of one where I miss the good old days when I could describe my knees as left and right versus good at bad.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of one of those interesting things. It's cool that you began your process in like inverted from mine, in that you early liked the forms. My wife really loved the forms, and she's very, very graceful, and she's probably way better at the technical execution of some of the aspects of the forms than I'll ever be. So we all have our strengths, but she started liking the forms a lot, and then came into the sparring and the drilling later in her career, whereas I was sparring and drilling early, and then came into the appreciation of forms, you know, much later.
So what was the turning point for you on liking the forms? Is there anything in particular? Was it gradual?
Partially it was gradual. And then there were times in my life when the training was just purely personal, either because I was alone or, out and hiking myself or whatever, and I wanted to train something. And so I'm obviously not going to, you know, bring an uke with me to do a drill. So I would train a form, or I would train some kind of a technique sequence that I'd been practicing. And then I started working on the forms as more of what they're essentially designed. Yes, they're combative models, but they're like moving forms of meditation. So as you're running through these forms and you're doing all these exercises and putting yourself in positions of, you know, advantage to your opponent or getting off the line and these types of things, you're also running through a mental drill, if you will, of how all that stuff is not only put together, but how you can thread the timing together and do these things in a certain way that gives you more advantage. And so as you kind of run through those little moving meditations, you can't help but sort of like, if you make your bed every day and you do this disciplined thing, like in basic training, if you do these patterns in exactly this order, well, discipline flows into other areas of your life. It's like an ice cube tray. You flood one compartment and it starts to flood the rest of them just by the course of design. And so for me, running the forms in isolation when nobody else was watching, so I wasn't concerned about how I looked or whatever. I was concerned with how I was actually in the rhythm with my own body and my own sequencing and how I interpreted like the combative elements and moments to be. That kind of helped me transcend the idea that it's just a block of patterns for a belt or something, and it actually can have some meaning and be useful to you, you know, in your other aspects. And then again, they would always say like, we don't do forms and whatever in martial arts that are like MMA. And I'd say, but you shadow box, right? And they go, yeah. And I go, what are you doing in shadow? You're shadow boxing a fake partner, your shadow? And they go, yeah. And I was like, that's the same kind of drilling. It's just honed for that specific style of sport, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, and I love that. I had heard someone else mention that or use that same logic that you know, doing a form is just the same as shadow boxing, and so I really love phrasing it that way and looking at it that way, because I mean that's what it is. You're still, they're still part of those bricks that are built, those building blocks. It's still an important part of that, and so yeah, I always, people that are kind of against forms, I'm like, no, there's a point. If there wasn't a point for it, then it would get removed from the system.
We have to disguise repetition in a variety of ways. Like in Kenpo, like if you're looking at our basics, from my perspective, I'm a kickboxer by nature, so I go right power side back. So I right side back, and I, you know, like a boxer would power side back. But all of our, not all, but largely our Kenpo techniques are built with power side forward. And there's reasons behind putting your most articulate and powerful hand forward, obviously, too. But it kind of depends on which style you're coming from. So having some cross-training experience, wrestlers don't care if it's the right or the left. They know the techniques equally on both sides. And that's sort of important to know how ambidextrous wrestlers are. If you are a boxer and you end up, you know, having to switch to southpaw all of a sudden, and you're totally, like, your jab is no longer fluid, it's all out of whack and everything's screwed up and your angles are completely inverted. So you have this sense where, oh, if it's like kickboxing and boxing, we're we can be a little bit ambi, but we have a very strong preference for one side back or whatnot. Whereas wrestlers and like in my experience, Filipino style practitioners, these guys are much more ambidextrous than the typical, you know, Western boxer, kickboxer, etc. And those little tidbits of information are, you know, not only necessary, they may be the difference between you being able to pull something off or not, if you're just aware of that.
No, I'm so glad that you said that in that in the first school that I started with, we didn't really work things on both sides that much. And the instructor that I train with now, we do everything on both sides. One of the things that he says, yeah, is, so he's left-handed, and he said, well, I had to learn everything, you know, on the right-hand side. So, since I had to learn it that way, you're going to have to learn everything. You're going to have to learn everything on the left side. So you get to share the suffering. But, I, you know, there are schools of thought that are like, oh no, you don't need to do them on both sides. And, I am very much a champion for doing it on both sides. I think in my training, it's helped significantly to be able to work on both sides and get both the mind and the brain to really put in that extra work to do it. So, sorry for those that are not
fan of it. It's interesting.
But I like it. So.
Yeah, I tell everybody, I'm an interesting character because I was born in 73, and for some weird reason in the 70s, being left-handed was considered like evil or bad or whatever. And so when I was a child, I was left-hand dominant, and they actually forced me to sit on my left hand, and they forced me to be right-handed. And so I'm actually cross-dominant, which is very weird. So if I'm shooting like a pistol, I'm sighting it with my left eye because it's my dominant eye always. But if I have to shoot a rifle, then I have to close the left eye to have my optic, because I'm my left eye is way more dominant. And so unfortunately, I'm dyslexic now, largely probably because they forced me to use my non-dominant hand. And so so sometimes those crossover things for me are more difficult. But then also sometimes I can cross over inadvertently, and I'm pretty fluid with it. And it's almost like a mastery in disguise, accidental, because I didn't really try to be ambidextrous. Sometimes it was just, I screwed it up, and I'm inverting something that sometimes happens, you know, and particularly if we're doing flow drills or doing like a Kali Hubid drill or something like this, you're going to see me invert to the left side almost just on happenstance. But sometimes it's a superpower, and other times it's, if I ever point and say, turn right, if I'm go the direction I'm pointing, not what I said.
Yeah, I like that. And there's many techniques that I always end up doing on the second side, just for whatever reason. I'm so used to doing it on the second side, and it's like, oh no, we're supposed to do that on the first side and then do it on the second side. So yeah, I feel the struggle of sometimes you get caught up in the switch. So very nice. So
yeah, for sure.
Let's roll it back to the teaching side a bit here. So was the teaching aspect something that you were always interested in, or like many of my guests, was it thrust upon you? And you just kind of went from there?
You know, it's a good question. When I started in the school I was in, we didn't have a yellow belt. We just went to orange belt. And it took me 7 months to get my orange belt. We did learn 35 techniques. I did short and long one and whatnot. And right after I got my orange belt, they invited me to like instructor's class. And it was this like, you know, seemingly hush hush group, like, this is instructor's class, you have to be invited. So it was like this special thing. And so of course I wanted to go. And then we went into the instructor's class, and they were training at a much higher level of force and so forth with the drills and the techniques hands-on. The sparring was at a much higher contact level. It was more akin to the kickboxing contact class, except we didn't have to have the big giant gloves on, so it was even better. And so I was very excited. And so for me, the instructor's class in those days was kind of was a little bit more – the training was kind of thuggish in that we were just really hitting hard and doing it pretty aggressively. But the learning curve was steep because we were throwing a lot of material at you in those classes. So I started teaching about 7 months into my training. And then I knew that's what I was going to do because I started Kenpo when I was 17. And by the time I was, you know, coming up on my 18th birthday, I already knew I'm going to run a school someday. And so I went to college, like little community college here, just to, you know, bide some time while I was teaching full time in the studio. And then I took over my first school that was my own in 94. It was in Pueblo, Colorado. And I grew up in Colorado for the early part of my childhood. And then I moved to Tucson. And so then my first school was in Colorado. And I ran that school from 94 until 99, so 5 years. And then I came back to Tucson, and this school's been around since 2001 is when I opened the Broadway location. It was in the same plaza around the building, but we got a great opportunity to actually purchase the 4,000 square foot building we're in now. And so so now every time I pay my monthly rent, there's a small chunk goes to equity.
Very nice, very nice. Very
but
nice.
It's fortunate that I got to buy the building, but I've been teaching my whole adult life. This is my 35th year in Kenpo, and 34 of them I've been instructing.
Very nice, very nice. I like it. So I've started asking my guests this question. I was kind of been involved in a conversation about what it means to be a black belt, what it takes to earn a black belt, and this sort of thing, because there is no standard for what constitutes being a black belt, earning a black belt. So I've decided to start asking my guests, in your opinion, what do you think makes a person eligible for a black belt? What constitutes a person being a black belt? What does it mean to be a black belt?
That's a great question, and I'll say it for every student that definition will be slightly altered, because I teach students from all walks of life. I mean, some of my advanced students are police officers. They work for, you know, local law enforcement, or they're working for the fire department or whatever it is. I've got you know, U of A college PhD level professors that do things. And so for them, like what defines them as a martial artist is different, because for a cop, he's putting, you know, he may have to do this physically on a not regular, but semi-regular basis, and certainly be ready to be executed physically anytime it's necessary. The college professor is not going to probably need to restrain his students or whatever. That's not necessary. So his level of physicality that he trains for is largely different. And of course, the age bracket changes things too. So depending upon whether you're, you know, past 50 and you're trying to work on, you know, things that are going to keep you safe with awareness and not falling, etc., you know, that there are different aspects of your training. But for the most part, the thing that kind of drives a stake through all of these reasons why these people are training and what is required to actually be considered a black belt in my school or in my eyes would be somebody who's willing to constantly refine the fundamentals and not be one of those people that collects information as if it's a book that they maybe read once and shelved it. No, this is a perishable skill. So you have to be continually refining and working these fundamentals and these basic skills. Yes, we still do punches from horses as a black belt, and we have the expectation that you're putting more effort into those fundamentals. And then on top of that first level, you're going to have to be able to take in information and then show, demonstrate the art that you're learning. Whether in our case it's Kenpo, but if it was jujitsu or whatever it is, you'd be demonstrating submissions. In our case, it's self-defense techniques and drills and some sparring ability, etc. And the third aspect that I would say is vital to, and no matter what style or whatever it is you want to put it on a black belt on somebody, that is a level of honest, humble introspection, because you're going to have to look at yourself, and your ego will need to be constantly adjusted throughout the entire course of your career. When you're younger, you should probably be smacking that ego down, because you're probably going to be pushing forward in ways that you should be a little more humble and a little more. So my younger students, I'm suppressing their ego and so forth. My older students, I'm encouraging them to be a little more protectionary of themselves and not push themselves forward to tilt into the drills extraordinarily hard, but rather be more withdrawn and make sure that you stay safe and etc. So, and that level of introspection is hard, because you'll have the young bucks that want to beat up everybody in class, and you can't let them like thump on the old timers. And at the same time, you'll have the old timers that can't give it up because they still want to prove that they're young and they could still do this. And I have to say, hey, introspection is required, and you have to train at your ability and always be pushing yourself, but not to a degree that it causes either overtraining, damage, etc. This is a marathon, not a sprint. And you have to, if you're going to be a lifelong martial artist, and if you want to be a black belt, I see that as being a lifelong martial artist. So if that's what you want to do, you have to be willing to always be introspective. Hit the fundamentals, be a good example of the art, and then personal introspection, so that you can tune these things up and down as you flow through your life in training, because there'll be times when you're injured and you can train just a little. There'll be times when you're healthy and you can train a lot, and you have to be dialing this constantly and not require everybody around you to do it for you.
Very nice. Very nice. Very well said. I like that. Great. So then the next point that I wanted to touch on is the kind of evolution of Kenpo. So in all of your years of training, are there things that maybe we used to do that you would like to see come back, and vice versa? Are there things that we do now that you wish you would have had back then? And then the kind of the second part of that is where do you see the kind of the future of Kenpo going, and where would you like to see it go?
These are great questions. I think regarding the old school Kenpo, or you know, things that I would like to see brought back, something that we do like, it's called an Iron Monkey exercise, where we just run the forms from short one, then long one, all the way up through form six. And we do this with our students in, like, sometimes we'll have a seminar class where we start the morning with that. And it's just that moving together in sequence, that where you're kind of and this happens before the seminar classes. So we gather as like a private exercise to, hey, we're just going to get together and train before all this. We're going to run the forms. And so whether it's that type of a training, or whether people bring their sparring equipment and after class they run some drills and some extra sparring, I like it. And we used to do it more, it seems like. We used to do it more in the old days, like I'm not that old, but back in the day, and everybody says this, back gotcha. In my day or whatever.
No, I gotcha.
But back in the day, we used to get together and train and practice a little bit more outside the framework of class, etc. And so I'd like to see more of that outside the framework of class, people being like, you know, Kenpo brothers and sisters gathering together to practice and just sharpen themselves, you know, and just train together. I think that's sometimes missing. It's not always missing, but I'd like to see more of that. As far as things that I would like to see fade away or not be involved, I think most of what I'd like to see fade away is attitude based. And so it's that my way or the highway, or, you know, if you're not, if you're not getting a hernia, getting kicked, you're not training hard or something ridiculous. Where it's an older mindset, and you'll see a lot of people that maybe they don't have a school, or they're not as relevant or whatnot. They don't have a big following, so their way is so important to them because it's a narrow scope laser. They're shining it to just a few people, and of course, if you're just teaching three or five people, you can make a standard that is extraordinarily high, and you can have them train for 10 years before they promote or whatever it is. But that's because you have that narrow laser focus on just a couple people. If you're doing it in a broader sense, you know, it's a little bit different. And so I think it depends on, if you just let the attitudes go, that's cool. You can teach those three people and have a really top, you could teach like Navy SEAL Kenpo, right? But you've got a very small team. If you're teaching a bigger team, you're going to have students that span the skill set from, you know, the autistic kid that's struggling in class just to keep up to the person that is, you know, very, very, very skilled and probably bored in the group setting because he could be going faster and be doing more. So you kind of have to you have to be able to span those gaps. And I see a lot of, like what I'll say, old-time instructors, they're very focused on, they're only teaching advanced level students. And so that gives them a sense that everybody should be learning only like an advanced level student. And so they see the other lessons that are less than that, and they're like, these aren't valid. And I'm like, well, of course they are. They're just, you're kind of crusty in your thinking.
Yeah. It's important to evolve. Evolving doesn't necessarily mean that we're throwing away things or changing things just for the sake of changing. It's we're moving with the times, moving with just the world itself changing. I mean, we could use the example of a lot of arts. You know, you don't need to learn a spear or you know, whatever insert weapon, because we can't carry such and such weapons. And I recently had heard about a class seminar of somebody, and they were teaching techniques based off of things like carrying a flashlight or having a carabiner, things like that you would more likely carry. You know, I mean, us Kenpo people, yeah, we might be more likely to have a knife or a karambit or something like that. But you know, your average Joe Blow on the street, you know, they're probably not going to have a knife or anything like that. But flashlight is perfectly something that one might have, or you know, using that like a couputon or a pen or something like that, and that's part of the evolution of things in society. We have these different things, and we need to have outlets where we can train with the things that we're actually going to have. So evolving is not a scary word.
I mean, nunchakus are awesome. Yeah, nunchakus are awesome, but they're just not very practical to carry.
Exactly. And legal in most places.
I think practicality is important.
Yeah,
it's kind of an interesting thing too. A lot of the critiques I see of different techniques or what, particularly in this modern era of like here we are zooming this meeting or whatnot. So we have this modern technology, and people will critique things, but a lot of their critiques are context driven. So like, for example, if you're a Filipino martial artist and like you're familiar with like rapid fire, lightweight stick techniques, the you're not going to be able to do things. But if you defend yourself against like a weapon of opportunity that may be a stick, could be a wrench or whatever, a heavy weapon, if they swing a heavy weapon, it's more of a committed strike. You can do different things that you would defend. And if you tried to do that type of defense against a modern Arnis practitioner that has a proper weapon in hand, you're done. You're not going to – the technique that you're applying for a wrench that's a full, like, weighted strike is not the same thing as a multi-directional swing-back weapon that you can do abanico and all these other techniques with. So it's context-driven. Sometimes they'll be doing a drill that is purely timing-based, and we're sitting there picking it apart going like, that's not practical in self-defense. You're going to get killed and all this other stuff. And they're like, it's just a timing drill. We're just doing a timing drill. Relax. And so a lot of times as we look into the viewfinder, it goes back to that question you asked me about the black belts. When I'm looking at somebody else's drill or somebody else's student or somebody else's like operation or whatever, I'm looking at a narrow window of what is a bigger thing. And I have to make sure that I understand. I have no idea where that student came from, what they've overcome, all these other, I'm just looking at a pinpoint in time. And so we have to make sure that we're not too quick to decide that we know what is and isn't effective, not, etc., because certain things you could teach somebody a timing drill and it's fine. I could show somebody how to do a hula hoop to show them how their hips could work, but that doesn't mean they fight like that.
Exactly.
we teach juggling because it's cross body coordination and it teaches these types of things. And if you can pick up things in the air like this, or you can pick jabs, then you can start working your slips while you're doing multiple things. But I'm not going to bring like juggling balls around and use that for self-defense. It's purely to teach coordination, and then you can transfer that to picking punches, etc.
Very nice. I like that. I've always been terrible at juggling, so need to get on your system there and learn that. Very nice, very nice.
Yeah, like, that's a sideline drill. It's not part of our main curriculum, but you know, it does teach coordination. I do show it.
Very good, very good. All right, so we're going to move into our lightning round here. I just got a few little questions as we head towards wrapping up our time today. First one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Ooh, the answer is absolutely, and I'll tell you, it depends on the emotional state of my energy when you ask me the question. So typically speaking, if I'm in like the aggressive, like Sean kind of a mindset, I would say probably thundering hammers, or as we call it, hammering ram. It stays on the outside for primarily, but it's just back and forth rotationally brutal. And then if I were in more of a, like my in tight type situations, things like this, I would have to say, you know, five swords, which we call countering ram, just because it's got that initiation off the we're doing sword hands and so forth, but it's basically a jab cross hook pattern or timing. And so for me, that's because of the kickboxing base. This is where my Kenpo and my kickboxing timing fuse together really, really well. Makes my OCD tingle. So I guess it would depend on whether I wanted to be inside or outside and how excited I was, or, you know, wanting to hit hard.
Very nice. I like it. I like it. Like I like to call them the Kenpo All-Stars, the techniques that seem to be in every version of Kenpo. And so, yeah, your thundering hammers, your five swords, snapping twig, ones like that, see in every version.
Exactly.
I asked one of my previous guests, who is not a Kenpoist, as we were talking, he was like, oh, like I know five swords and I teach it to my students. And it's like, yeah, I think that's a testament to that technique that non-Kenpoists would not only know of it, but teach it as well. So, yeah, that's definitely one of the greats.
Yeah.
All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Oh, for sure. My favorite set is finger set easily. And then my favorite form, this goes back to that same thing, depends on how much energy I have to let loose of. If it's a short burst of energy and I'm wanting to like get out something, I would definitely pick short three. If it was a longer burst of energy and I wanted to kind of flow or meditate, it would be form four.
Very nice. Very nice. I like it. All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite weapon?
The one that I'm carrying is my karambit, so I would probably pick that. Outside of my daily carries, I would probably say the staff, and the reason because I spent a lot of time with Stephen LeBounty doing his version of what he called cudgel staff. And he learned it from Chuck Sullivan and then went down to Chinatown and they said, hey, you want us to fix it? Because he wasn't tucking his elbow so you could hit that elbow if you weren't careful. So anyway, we figured how to tuck these elbows and whatnot. And so whenever I run that particular form, it makes me think of, my teacher, Seagung, and that kind of brings me joy.
Oh, very nice, very nice. We are kindred spirits in that I've been telling myself that I'm going to start carrying a karambit and I want to get more and more into that. And then, the staff has always been my go-to. So, we definitely connect there.
Excellent.
All right. Next question.
I like
it. Anyone you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides Ed Parker, who would that be?
Boy, that would be a tough one because I mean, my mind immediately flashes to like all the greats of of course you're going to put like Bruce Lee or Yip Man, somebody like his teacher. You'd put these greats in play, or you'd say maybe you could go back to the Shaolin Temple and be a fly on the wall and watch like with the birth of all this was happening or something. But I'm more of a simpleton, and I would say. The man that brought me from Traco or the Tracy's branch into Ed Parker's was Stephen LeBounty. I would have another class with him. It wouldn't matter whether we did horse stance basics for an hour or whether we did cudgel staff or whether we just sat and talked about, philosophy and technique. Wouldn't matter. Just more time with the man that I love.
Very nice. I like it. All right, final question there. What is something that either always motivates you to train or what is something that you would want to put out there that would motivate someone to get out there and train? So let me kind of frame this in a certain way. So I use the movie Rocky IV, and there's the scene where he's the training montage and the music's going, he's running through the snow, all that good stuff. And anytime the million times that I watch that movie, I see that scene and I'm ready to go ahead and hit the mats, get in the studio and get to training. So if there's something like that for you, what is that? And or if you prefer to put out something motivational, what do you have there?
Well, probably for me, martial arts was very much about empowerment. When I grew up in a drug house, and there was a lot of physical abuse and things were difficult. I took a lot of physical damage, so much so that I can't have my own kids. So I grew up that way. And then when I had the orbit fracture, that kind of pushed me back towards a place and a time when I felt helpless. And so martial arts was the vehicle by which got me out of that sense of helplessness. And so it empowered me to one, taught me how to fight back. And more so than that, as it taught me how to fight back, it taught me that I was worth defending. And so it instilled some sense of value and worth within me that was lacking. And so For me, why I train and why I did begin to train and why it was such a draw to me was because of all of that. Why I continue to train is because no matter what comes up in life, you are your own worst obstacle, opponent, etc. And so you're gonna have to be fortifying yourself and being your own coach and being your own instructor as a martial artist. You'll have time with your coach, hopefully a lot of it. But then when you're in the quiet moments, it's up to you to do the reps. It's up to you to do the push-ups or whatever the exercise is that you need to work on, because that's where you're weak, not where you're strong and you can feel good. It's where you got to dig in, pull, roll up your sleeves and go, my little chicken legs keep skipping the gym, and I got to build these calves up because, you know, I can bench press all this weight and I look real impressive. But of course, we skip the thing we're not good at. And so you have to be that guy that encourages you. And you have to remind yourself that, like in Rocky, the movie, he's fight, you know, he's going to go fight this Russian, et cetera, whatever he's going to do. Well, that's you. You're going to have to go fight you. And every day you don't show up, the you fight is stronger and you are weaker. And so you got to build yourself up to kind of have this balance within yourself so that you can, in fact, look at life with a little bit more balance, ballast, and not be kind of so whimsical and emotionally drawn. When I was younger, I would want to prove myself, and so if somebody called me stupid, I'd be like, "No, I'm not," and I would want to explain why I'm not. And this is ridiculous, but that was because there was true vulnerability that I needed to train myself to become confident enough to go, "I don't have to do that." And so it helps you in so many ways. We tend to look at one way or one ever thing, like I need self-defense or I need fitness or I need one thing will be the thing that draws you in. But the thing that'll generally keep you there, and the reason why I would train in any martial art, starts with one of those things: self-defense, confidence, fitness, etc. But the reason it'll become such a big part of your life is because it shows you how to fortify yourself both physically and mentally. And this is, it's worth far more than any tuition I ever paid. It's invaluable. It's just amazing.
Excellent. Excellent. I like that. All right. So we are now at our final piece of business for today, and that is the shameless self-promotion. So you can plug anything that you'd like, or if there's anything that we did cover that you'd like to get out there today, you now have the floor, and then we will wrap from there.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. What I'd like to, my shameless plug won't really be for myself. It'll be to honor the people that have meant the most to me. I mean, I try to do a good job and be a good steward of my art, Kenpo Karate, but the reason I have any level of success or something of tremendous value to share is only because of the people who shared with me. And so the people that I give credit to would be Bill Packer for his organization for teaching me how to fight and do kickboxing, Stephen LeBounty for bringing me into Ed Parker's American Kenpo, John Sepulveda for continuing to coach me, and he's still doing so today. And then Lee Wedlake, the one of the coaches I've spent the most amount of time with in my career. Those men, LeBounty, Sepulveda, Wedlake, and White, he coached me on basics, and he was also my sobriety coach. So these four giants we call the Four Horsemen, those are the people, if I have anything of tremendous value to offer, it's because I've picked up some of the many lessons that they've given, and I'm trying to echo them to the best of my ability.
Very nice. Very nice. All right. So I thank you so much for taking the time to share your story, and look forward to getting this out to the listeners. And as I kind of say with all of my guests, we'll definitely have to do a part two and three and four and get into more topics. But you have a open invite to be on anytime. And once again, I just thank you for sharing your time and your story with me.
Well, I appreciate it very much. And thank you for the service you do for the martial arts community. It's well appreciated.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.